Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Sunstone Fireside Podcast. I'm your host, Blair Osler. Today, we have a very thought-provoking podcast for you. Today, we're going to be discussing the idea of a technological resurrection. Even the title of the podcast alone should be intriguing to you. At first, your imagination might move to ideas of Darth Sidious in Star Wars Episode 9, or perhaps you like the old classics like Frankenstein. But what if the idea of a technological resurrection wasn't some dystopian fiction? What if a technological resurrection was as normal as CPR or a blood transfusion? What if a technological resurrection is how eternal families are created? What if a technological resurrection is exactly what Mormon theology has promised? We're going to talk about all this and more. We're going to talk about some medical breakthroughs that are happening and all sorts of great ideas in relation to this. And to discuss the topic with me today, I brought on two of my best pals from the Mormon Transhumanist Association. As many of the listeners know, I've served on the board of the Mormon Transhumanist Association for about 5 years now. And there's no one else I'd rather be discussing this topic with than Mormon transhumanists, especially these two Mormon transhumanists, because they know what they're talking about. Tonight, I have with me Lincoln Cannon, who is the founder of the Mormon Transhumanist Association, and Dr. Jordan Roberts, who is also a member of the association. I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves. And Lincoln, let's go ahead and start with you. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to everyone and tell us why you're a Mormon transhumanist.
All right. Thank you, Blair. It's good to be on the show with you. And thanks for the invitation. I'm a Mormon transhumanist. Well, first of all, my background's in technology and I grew up a Mormon. So when you kind of combine those two things, that leads towards Mormon transhumanism naturally. And in fact, I would say that I've always been a Mormon transhumanist, although I didn't know what the word transhumanist meant until sometime around, let's see, it would have been 2004-ish when I was about 30 years old. So I'm a Mormon transhumanist because, explicitly now, because I identified in the transhumanist movement a way of articulating many of the things that Mormon theology taught me as a child and as a youth growing up, many of the things that inspired me most about what it is to be a Mormon. So I've always valued my religion and I've always valued practical ways of approaching it, logical ways, rational ways to complement the emotional strength that it can bring, the inspiration that it can bring. And I found in transhumanism ways of strengthening that connection between the rational and the emotional sides of my religion and of my aspirations. And so that's what led me to be a Mormon transhumanist. On a personal level, I've been a software engineer. I've been an entrepreneur, technology. I've got a degree in philosophy, a degree in business. So I've done a lot of different things and they've taught me a lot of things. And I try to bring those into the conversations that I have about technology and religion and particularly Mormon transhumanism.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Jordan, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? And hey, for the loyal listeners, this is Jordan's second time on the podcast. Last time we had a conversation about COVID-19. And so we are lucky enough to be graced with Dr. Roberts' knowledge again. So Jordan, please introduce us to yourself and tell us why you're a Mormon transhumanist.
Blair, it's good to be back on the Sunstone podcast, and I appreciate all of the work that you do across the many intersections of the Mormon intelligentsia. I think you're a jewel, and we're all very lucky to have you, and it's a great honor and pleasure to be here with my friend Lincoln today, too. So Lincoln and the Mormon transhumanist movement were a really a key part to kind of salvaging my spiritual world when my house of cards kind of fell down about 7 years ago. So I was an undergrad in my pre-medical studies and had a major crisis of faith. I was still attending church every week and I began to have thoughts about like, how can I integrate what I'm learning about science and the world and how I'm seeing the world differently now and still maintain some semblance of my Mormon cultural heritage without having to just throw out the baby with the bathwater. And I felt pretty comfortable, I guess, in the ward I was in at the time, comfortable enough to muse out loud one day when we were talking about the resurrection, that, you know, what if the resurrection is just like mind uploading? You know, like we just create like a digital version of our souls on computers, and that's how we have immortality. And most of the people gave me a really weird look and just kind of pretended like I hadn't said anything. But one gentleman in particular caught me afterwards and kind of whispered in my ear, "You should look up the Mormon Transhumanist Association."
Like it's a secret underground thing. It's totally legit. It's underground.
So I went and Googled it that night and read the declaration and read Lincoln's bio and some of his writings and was immediately taken. I thought, where has this been? You know, so I began to be involved in the association back then while still studying in Arizona. And then about 5 years ago, we moved up here to Salt Lake City for my residency after medical school. And then I was able to start to participate in person, which was great. So that's how I became a Mormon transhumanist. And on a personal note, I am a family medicine doctor in Salt Lake City, 2 years into my practice, and a very, very happy new Utahn. I think this is our, you know, forever home here. We love it. It's just so unique. And I really enjoy my practice. It's changed a lot in the last few months. I've gone from seeing a lot of people in person to doing mostly my visits like this over, you know, platforms like, you know, similar to Zoom. I think we're all figuring out this new normal, you know, and it's at least one way to stay connected, which I think is important.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for agreeing to be on the show or the podcast. Okay. So how this idea got started for me that I really wanted to talk about this subject is I made a post on Facebook a while ago, a few months ago actually, and it was about a technological resurrection. And I was surprised at some of the comments I got because a lot of people had some objections to this and this idea that I was just kind of like, duh. People were like, no. And so there were objections, philosophical objections. There were religious objections to it. And there were also some like technological, like medicinal objections to this. And I was like, okay, well we're going to talk about this. Okay. So I want to first get started. We're on Sunstone, a Mormon podcast. I want to get started with you, Lincoln. And I want to have the listeners have a better understanding of how does the technological resurrection fit into the idea of Mormon theology. In Mormon theology, it's easy, we have this resurrection, but why do we care about a technological resurrection and actually having a hand in making this a reality besides temporal ritual?
Sure, yeah. A question that probably comes to mind almost immediately for a faithful member of the church is, if we're talking about technological resurrection, does that mean Jesus doesn't matter? And the answer to that question is Jesus does matter, from my perspective, greatly. And here's why. Jesus matters because Jesus is the one who told us to raise the dead. You can go read that in the Bible. And then Jesus's disciples come along and they write in the New Testament that our faith in the teachings of Jesus is dead without action, without works. So we should do something about it. The examples that James gives in the New Testament are that we should not just come along and see a hungry person and say, be fed. That's not sufficient. That's kind of actually a joke, right? Instead, we actually need to give them food. We can't just come up to a naked person and say, be clothed. We actually have to give them clothes. So when Jesus tells his disciples to go console and to heal and to raise the dead, I don't think he means that we should just say with a loud voice, be consoled, be healed. And by the way, if you're dead, be raised. I think he actually means that we should try to do something about that. We should put some kind of action behind our faith in resurrection. Later on in the New Testament, you've got Paul who of course writes most of the text in the New Testament, who talks about a day that will come when the dead will be raised to immortality. But then he says, I'm going to share a mystery with you, a great mystery. And that is that we will not all sleep, but we will be changed in the twinkling of an eye and put on immortality. And so when we start seeing these kinds of messages in the New Testament, I think it should start to spark this idea that maybe Jesus was serious, and maybe we aren't taking Jesus seriously enough. Then you move forward into the Latter-day Saint, the Mormon tradition, into the authoritative texts of the church as we know it today. And you've got things like where Joseph Smith in the 128th section of the Doctrine and Covenants is talking about the work for the dead. And he goes and he says, by the way, God ordained before the world was that which would enable us to redeem our dead. In other words, God expects us to do something about it. Now, of course, most people think, well, that just means going and doing the ritual work at temples. And I would say that's great. We need to do the ritual work at temples, but why stop there? Do the scriptures say that's where we're supposed to stop in our work to redeem the dead? Just do the rituals? I don't think the scriptures say that anywhere. If somebody can ever find that, that'd be great, and they can point it out to me. But in the meantime, it sounds to me like a great beginning. It sounds like a way of turning our hearts to our parents, like the prophecies say. And then taking that opportunity to have our hearts turned to act on those changed hearts, to do something about it, to learn about their histories, to gather information about them. And then what do? When we have all of this information gathered about them, do we just stop and we say, hey God, we gathered all this information? I kind of expect God will turn around and say, you know what? You've got a great database. What are you going to do with all of that data now?
Like, my answer here, God, is, here's the USB. What do I do with it?
That's right. And I think that God will ask us what we want to do with it, right? Maybe it's a little bit like the story of the brother of Jared, where God says, well, you need to go to this destination, the new world, the promised land, or in our case, the millennial world with resurrected families. You need to go there. You really should go there. Well, God, how are we going to get there? I don't know. You tell me, how do you want to get there? Well, I've got these white stones. Could you do something with them? Well, thanks for asking. I can help you out with those. So maybe that's kind of like temple work, right? We bring our data. We do everything we can. We bring them to God and we say, hey, can we work with this? And maybe God helps us figure out how to do that and to reach our promised land. So it might be something like that. But going back to the original question, does Jesus matter? I think Jesus matters a great deal when it comes to this question of technological resurrection, because Jesus invites us to faith in raising the dead. He commands us to raise the dead. He sets the example of rising from the dead in the New Testament, which motivates us to this aspiration of its possibility. And then beyond that, Jesus invites us, even commands us, to join him and be one with him in Christ. And what is that? Well, again, it's to console, it's to heal, it is to raise the dead. And I don't think we're taking our discipleship of Jesus Christ seriously enough unless we're trying to do everything that he set the example of doing.
Thank you. That was very thorough. That was perfect. A few of the scriptures that you touched on that were key for me in changing my mind was Jesus explicitly inviting us into the body of Christ in Corinthians 12. And then the scripture that said, and go and do works greater than I have done. And I'm like, well, he raised people from the dead. What's greater than that? You know what I mean? So it's like an explicitly clear indication in the scriptures that, okay, hey, you're now a part of the body of Christ. You're going to do all the miracles I'm going to do. And guess what? These are all the miracles I already did. And you're going to do ones even bigger than that. And it's like, oh, so we have to take this seriously. Another interesting thing with what you were talking about, but I want to point out that this idea doesn't hinge upon whether people take the scriptures as fiction or nonfiction, right? So at Sunstone, we have a huge breadth of people who subscribe to the scriptures. Some people consider it to be just this beautiful work of fiction, and we should use it to create our moral codes and purpose and meaning. and other people take it, no, this is directly the word of God. Even through all the translations, this is it. That's probably more the Book of Mormon than the Bible. But this idea of a technological resurrection doesn't hinge on whether or not, you know, you take the Book of Mormon historically or not, or whether you believe the Bible to be fiction or not, or anywhere in between. This is the idea, and you nailed it right at the end when you said, if we are disciples of Christ, whatever you believe that to be, this is what Christ is saying in the text, in the scriptures. And so this is an idea, basically, if you subscribe to Christianity, and even bigger than Mormonism, if you subscribe to Christianity, you should kind of be subscribing to this idea as a disciple of Christ. So beautiful. Thank you so much. I couldn't have said it better. One of the things I also want to ask you about is the idea of hubris and the Tower of Babel. Like, people are going to be, people with more strict interpretations of scripture might say, oh, you're just building your own demigod, you know? What can you say to those concerns?
I think that's a legitimate, even a momentous concern. The technologies that we're developing today, the emerging biotechnologies that we have now and that we will have in the future, are dangerous things. They are things that we can use to raise ourselves above each other, to oppress each other, to do truly horrible, even diabolical acts towards each other. And caution and reverence for the power of these technologies is definitely called for. So again, returning to the New Testament, we've said a lot of things about that. In the New Testament, Paul talks about two different kinds of gods, one a would-be God and one that he actually thinks is God. The would-be God he describes as that which would raise itself above all else, declaring itself God, raising itself above all else that's called God. And he associates that with the son of perdition or Satan. And of course, that's not the God that Paul advocates. In contrast, he talks about another kind of God, another person that he thinks actually is a better God. And that's, of course, Jesus Christ. And he says that we are called to be joint heirs in the glory with this God, with Christ. We're called to be joint heirs, if so be that we suffer with him. And I think that little qualification there at the end, that we're called to be joint heirs in the glory of God with Christ, in Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, I think is key to all of this, because we need to use the technologies that we have today for each other. It's not going to be enough, and unfortunately it is advocated among some transhumanists, for some technological elite to have access to these technologies. In fact, I can think of a few things that would be worse than for that kind of outcome. It's not enough for just men or just white dudes or just old dudes to have access to these technologies. We're in the middle of a major race crisis in the United States right now, and for good reasons. And when people hear about these kinds of things, one of their gut reactions is going to be, oh, so the rich white dudes can have eternal life or immortality, and the rest of us, we can just burn, right? Nothing would be a worse outcome than something like that. And there are people who aspire to using these technologies just for themselves and just for people just like them. In contrast to that, I think we see a very clear Christian call to a universal resurrection, to using whatever means we've acquired by the grace of God, whatever technologies and powers we might have by that grace, for each other, in behalf of each other, to raise each other from the dead and to help each other attain immortality. So yes, there definitely are ways that this could be approached dangerously and with hubris of the most profound sort. In contrast, there are also ways that this can be approached compassionately, altruistically for all of us. And it's that second way of doing things that I think pretty much every Mormon transhumanist that I've ever met advocates.
Yeah, and I love that you said the idea of lifting each other up together, because that's what I think of when I think of like the Tower of Babel and all this hubris, is like when we put ourselves one on top of the other just to oppress people down lower, to let just you said it right, to let the elite rise. It almost creates like a species stratification, you know, where you have all these elite on top and all these people bearing the burden at the bottom. But that's not, at least I would say, the Mormon transhumanist vision or idea of a technological resurrection. It's exactly as you said, it's all of us working together to raise each other up together. It's together we rise. And if I may, this is a little self-indulgent here, but one of my favorite things in Mormon theologies is the idea of the hearts of the children will be turned to their parents. And I secretly have this fantasy vision that I think it would be so cool and so awesome if my children were the ones to resurrect me if and when I die, because I gave them life and it was hell and it was hard getting them here. And it would just seem so fitting and so beautiful that children would be able to return the favor to their parents. And if you think about it too, like on a theological, philosophical level, it really puts the power in the hands of our posterity, of future generations, to decide, is this someone I want to bring back or not? And so it puts the responsibility on us to, you know, at least be benevolent to our posterity and the next generation and the next generation and the next, for them to actually go back and say, you know what? That Blair Osler, you know what? She deserves a second chance. She said some good things. Sure, she didn't understand blah, 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 future things that I won't even know about. But you know what? She deserves a second chance. Let's bring her back. Let's bring her back. As opposed to digging through all the archaeological archives of dead people and being like, you know what? Maybe we'll get to Hitler later. Like, the world is okay without that for now. So it's really this beautiful, interesting idea in Mormon theology of, it's not about like building a hubris tower, you know, it's about fulfilling the prophecies that we hold dear. It's about our posterity and it's about benevolence and creating an environment in which we actually do want to bring people back. Imagine that, actually wanting eternal life, right? Which is funny, you know, thinking, I think there's a fair amount of, cynicism that goes around. And I know I've been a part of that too. I mean, people who have listened to this have heard all too much of my struggles, but this idea of like wanting eternal life. What are we doing right now to make ourselves want to be here forever, to want to be with each other? And I think that's what a lot of like social justice work or things like that are aimed at, this idea of like, it's not just about quantity of life, it's also about quality of life. And that's not to say it's always being done correctly, because it's not. But that's what's at the root of it.
There are things worse than death.
Yes, exactly. There are things worse than death. And so what I want to get into now is I want to hopefully shift and slide into some of Jordan's work. And I was able to listen to Jordan give a presentation at one of our Mormon Transhumanist Association meetups. Anybody local in Utah, oh, you can't come to our meetups anymore because we're not meeting because of stupid COVID-19. But we do virtual meetups now. So I guess anyone can come meet up. I need to leave some links and some thingies for you to do that. We'll do that, okay? Or if not, go to the Mormon Transhumanist Association website and you can find out more info there. Anyway, my friend Jordan here gave a presentation on this idea called vitrification. And it literally blew my mind. My jaw was like dropped on the floor, but in a good way. Like it made sense to me. And I was like, more people need to hear about this and what's going on with this. What's going on in the medical field? How are medical personnel's attitudes changing towards the idea of how we preserve bodies with the intent that we might want to do something else with them later? So Jordan, tell us what vitrification is and about your work and project.
Sure. So this actually started from an introduction that Lincoln helped with in January. There is an organization based out of MIT, I believe, called the Brain Preservation Foundation. And they've been tackling this problem of how do we preserve large mammalian brains like ours in a stable way that's sustainable, that's reproducible, that might, you know, allow consciousness, if you accept this assumption that your consciousness exists in your brain, which I think is a fairly well, you know, established assumption, and the components of your consciousness, things like memory, personality, thought patterns, the way you see the world can be imprinted in the actual hardware of your brain, not just coded in the chemical signals that change from second to second in the brain. In philosophy, this concept is referred to as an engram. And so the assumption here is that those engrams that make up you, you know, that create the soul that is Blair Osler, there is enough of them there in the physical structure of your brain that we, you know, if we could reboot that, that you would have something that, you know, would be, for all intents and purposes, you. And, you know, so the idea is, can you preserve the information that is stored in the physical structure of the brain to a high enough degree of fidelity that a future civilization that understands how consciousness emerges from the brain and the body, far better than we do, since that's still one of the greatest mysteries of science. You know, could a future civilization in, who knows, you know, 100 years, 1,000 years, be able to take that historical database that is your brain that's been well preserved and recreate you, either in the same vessel that was preserved through a process like cryopreservation or vitrification or both, or, you know, through some other substrate, be that digital, you know, silicone, et cetera. And so this organization has long fought against a lot of, you know, I think visceral, emotional kind of pushback from people that just see this as very, you know, kind of the essence of dystopia, you know, that this is, you know, cold, calculated technologism that just, you know, throws everything in the face about, you know, what it means to be human. And they've seen that that's a problem. You know, if this is ever going to be something that's going to be adopted on a wide scale, it's got to have appeal. It's got to overcome this kind of visceral gut reaction against it. And so as part of that that effort to try to understand, especially the point of view of religious people, a couple people from that foundation reached out to Lincoln, because Lincoln is a well-known figure in the transhumanist movement. And this, you know, topic lies well within the scope of transhumanism. And Lincoln mentioned me, you know, that I'm a person who has a medical background, is very interested in a technological resurrection. That's a cornerstone of my new spiritual life. And then they reached out to me and asked if I would be willing to, you know, to look at their emerging protocol and to offer some of my view on how this could maybe be, you know, applied on a more wide scale way, especially towards a group of people that comes from more faithful worldview, like Mormonism. And so they invited me out to their headquarters in San Francisco for this startup that had won the major Brain Preservation Foundation Award. Basically, they had created a protocol to preserve a large mammalian brain, and they had taken samples of that preserved brain and put them under a microscope right next to fresh brain that had not been preserved, but was just recently alive, you know, within the last few minutes. And they showed those slides under an electron microscope to some prominent, you know, highly credentialed neuropathologists. And they asked them if they could tell the difference. And those neuropathologists could not. They could not tell which brains were fresh and which brains had gone through this process of preservation. And that, of course, is exactly what they were hoping to hear. They were hoping to hear that the fidelity, the degree of resolution capture that they had achieved with their process was, you know, comparable to having that brain be almost freshly alive.
So forgive my reductive view of this. What you're saying is they took tissue from a live brain and then tissued from a thawed brain, and the experts could not tell the difference between them.
Basically correct. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, the whole point, to see, you know, can somebody develop a protocol that will preserve the brain so well you know, that an expert can't tell the difference between a living brain and a preserved brain. And the way that they, you know, cryopreservation has been around for a long time. This idea that you can put a body on ice, right, and prevent that natural degradation that comes with kind of, you know, death and degradation.
And can I interrupt you for one sec? Could you tell us right now what the standard process is? Because I don't think people understand the standard process of what a body already goes through right now to be preserved. Because preserving a body and tissue and things like that are something, it's something we already do. Could you briefly tell us what that is?
Well, absolutely. So, you know, most people today in the modern world, we'll, you know, we have this whole culture that's developed around death that was really brought, you know, into the consciousness by funeral home directors, morticians, and they do a process called embalming. Now, embalming's been around since ancient Egypt. The methods have changed over time, but essentially, what happens for most people now when they die is within a few hours after death has been declared, someone from the funeral home will come to collect the remains of the person who has passed away and take them to a funeral home where their blood is drained from the body and is replaced by an embalming fluid, something that contains formaldehyde or a similar fixative. And the process that happens is what we call a cross-linking. So all of the proteins inside that person's body are kind of meshed together, almost like a spider web being laid over it. And that prevents bacteria, fungi, and other things that normally would decompose our bodies after we die from being able to degrade those proteins that they've kind of evolved to eat. They can't recognize them anymore. The proteins are so denatured, so changed thoroughly by that fixing process with the formaldehyde that, you know, the body can't degrade in its normal way. Now, so this is already commonplace. You know, most people who have an open casket funeral or a viewing that takes place more than a day or two after they die are preserved with embalming fluid. This is nothing new. This is nothing radically different from the way that we die now. In fact, it's made certain things about dying a little less difficult than they used to be. You know, it used to be that, you know, you had to put that body in the ground quickly. And that really wouldn't give your family much chance to assemble and to celebrate your life or even to say goodbye to your remains before it had to be, interred. And now we can, you know, sometimes have a viewing within, you know, up to a week or 2 weeks after the person has died because we can embalm their body and stop that decomposition process. Is that what you were kind of asking? Like,
that's perfect. I just wanted to lay the groundwork for what is already happening because I want you to tell us what your project is and what we would do in addition or to replace that process of embalming that we already do right now. I said embalming. What's embalming?
It's okay. I getcha. So the protocol that these folks came up with, and this is, I'll just put out a couple names here. So the startup that I'm talking about is called Nectone and is led by Robert McIntyre, a PhD student from MIT who kind of stopped his studies before finishing his degree to pursue this project. And it was his idea that was a radical synthesis of a couple of things that other people were doing. He had a key insight into how he could combine those works. And so he invited me out to kind of talk about the protocol and try to come up with a way to make this more appealing to a wider audience. And so the protocol, without getting into too much detail, would require that a person pretty close to their death, so a person who has a terminal illness or who has sustained a life-threatening injury and probably has no chances of recovery, would be able to undergo a process prior to their death very quickly thereafter before the very sensitive tissue of the brain begins to decompose and begins to lose its integrity to, you know, replace that blood within the body with a fixative similar to formaldehyde. And after that process is done, they would then infuse another chemical, in this case, a chemical that helps turn the body into glass, a process called vitrification. And by combining those two processes and then cryopreserving that person's remains, so you have, in essence, this is what we call aldehyde-stabilized cryopreservation. You could preserve this person's entire body, including their brain, so well that, you know, there's no theoretical upward limit on how long that body could remain perfectly preserved, as long as you could maintain steady temperatures. You know, one thing that glass does not like is big fluctuations in temperature. It doesn't like to be heated and cooled and heated and cooled. It can develop small fractures and things like that in it. But if you can maintain those steady temperatures for a long time, and who knows, maybe with advances in material science, that temperature may be, you know, higher, maybe even room temperature. But if you could do that, then there's really no upward limit on how long that person's remains could be preserved. And of course, we're not speculating here about the ability to reboot consciousness from those remains. That remains to be seen. It's just a theoretical possibility at this point. There are some really good evidence-based, you know, assertions that have been made based on really rigorous animal studies that you know, really lean credence to this idea that thoughts and memories do exist independent of electrical signals. We know that electrical signals are stopped, right, when a person falls asleep, when they go under general anesthesia, and of course when they die. But does that mean that their memory is lost, that their personality is lost? You know, we don't think so. We think that those things are more physically encoded in the actual structure of the brain. And if that's true, and if we can preserve that structure, then as long as some future civilization can scan that database with high enough, you know, accuracy and reconstitute it in some way, then if there's no hard limit to what technology can do, then this process very well may be, you know, one key to unlocking lives beyond death.
I don't know about you, but I haven't left my house since March 14th. How did I do it, you ask? Well, after I ate everything in my freezer and then finished off the mustard, balsamic vinegar, and the horseradish packets from my fridge door, I dug into my food storage. The peaches were divine. The jalapenos were definitely worth the wait, and the pickled watermelon rinds from 1985 were so good that a couple of angels came and helped me eat some more after I finished my first bottle. Those are the blessings of food storage. And happily, Sunstone Magazine has been storing up plenty of Mormony goodness for you since 1975. I've been recording our best articles, both old and new, as audible quality podcasts, and posting them at patreon.com/sunstone. Head over and listen to a few of our free episodes, and then subscribe, and avail yourself of the decades worth of the best of Mormon thought and experience.
That's so fascinating. So, and I want to touch on this idea too about what technology is capable of in the future, right? Because I think sometimes people think a little too short-term, or they don't have big enough imaginations, frankly, because when we talk about the technological limits in 100 years or 200 years or 300 years, pending we take care of our planet and don't kill ourselves, our technological limit is probably unfathomable to most people, right? So imagine going back and talking to someone and trying to explain to them what a smartphone is, right? And explaining to them what a text message is and all these little things we take for granted with our little magical, you know, square phones in our hands and trying to explain to them what this is. They probably couldn't understand the fact that we could hold millions of songs on our phone and listen to them at our leisure whenever we please. So when we take into account something as simple as just our phones, I mean, imagine what's possible with technological resurrection, you know, this idea that we bring people back, this idea that death is this finite state. Well, this is an idea we've been pushing against since the beginning. This is why we invented hand soap, because we saw someone dying of disease and we thought, you know, maybe if we had this thing called hand soap and washed away this bacteria off their hands, they may not get that sick thing and then die. So we've been pushing against death this entire time. This is not a new idea. And even the idea of bringing someone back after they're dead, still not a new idea. This is why we have CPR. Oh my gosh, this person looks dead. Maybe they're not really dead. Maybe we can bring them back. But when someone comes back from CPR, or someone has been in some kind of heart surgery and they were legally dead or whatever, and they come back, we don't all of a sudden go, is that still you? Grandpa, is that still you? It's still Grandpa. He's still there. He came back. And so when we take into this idea of like bringing people back from the dead, I just want to say that we're already kind of sort of doing this on a very small, small scale, right? Like, I'm sure you could give even more examples, Jordan, than what I'm giving. Like, I think of, what are the electrical things that shock the chest? The defibrillators?
Yeah, defibrillator. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, defibrillators. I think of defibrillators. And like all the time, we're looking at people dying and saying, no, I don't like that. We're gonna fix that. We're gonna reverse that. We're gonna make sure that that isn't a permanent state for you. And that's the interesting philosophical idea about this idea of death. Death is kind of sort of relative to whatever kind of technological tools we have around us.
Right,
I've experienced this personally in my own life. When my second son was born, he came out and he was, air quotes, dead. He wasn't breathing. He didn't have a pulse. He was a weird color, a certain shade of purple blue. And guess what? Several nurses and doctors came in with their technological tools, and before you know it, a few minutes later, I have a crying baby on my hands who wasn't dead anymore. And I tell this story to my son all the time to instill in him this idea of resurrection being a possibility, because that's very much what it was. And that was my experience as his mother. That was my experience. I had a C-section. I was lying on the operating table. I thought my child was dead, you know? And then before you know it, pump, electrical, blah, blah, blah. I still don't know what was going on. I was heavily drugged at the time. And then lo and behold, here's this baby. This baby isn't dead anymore. However, had this happened 50 years ago, they would have said it was a stillbirth and buried this baby. So this idea of like bringing someone back from the dead is totally relative on the technology we have around us. And then when you think about in 100 years where our technology is going from there, I mean, who knows what we'll be bringing back and when we'll be bringing them back and what this relative state of death will look like at that point. So more specific questions about vitrification that I wanted to ask you is, do you see the process then as maybe more of just data preservation? So it's more like, here's the roadmap, here's all the information that makes up Blair Osler. We're going to just preserve that because we don't know what to do with it yet. Is that how?
I think that's the gist of it. Yeah, you're trying to preserve the Library of Alexandria, right? Because you know that you may not understand what a treasure trove you have, but you know that that information is really important to future generations for them to understand what life was like in, you know, that time and for that person. Is that enough? I don't know. You know, there's some question about, well, what about like the imprint that you leave on the world, the social connections you have made, the content that you've created and put there out into the world, you know, the memes that you've left, you know, your legacy there. You know, what about all that? Isn't that part of you as well? And if so, that stuff's, you know, quite a bit easier to save right now. You know, we have, you know, a lot of storage devices available for saving, you know, your Facebook posts and your blog posts and your, you know, your journal entries and things like that. Shouldn't that be part of some sort of long-term storage so that they can use that information to kind of bootstrap, you know, the, you know, let's take it a little further. Let's say that in this future civilization where people really understand what to do with this database, it's a virtual world where they boot you up to, right? And so how do they create a virtual space that will feel familiar and comfortable to you that won't, you know, that you won't be exposed to too much future shock? I think those are all really valid questions. I don't think we have a good answer. But I know that what we need right now is we need reproducibility. We need to be able to show that this process works, that it's scalable, right? If we want this to be the way that people die in the future, to give them this chance at living beyond their natural death, then we need a bank of brains. And that's the next step in the development of this. You know, so this company, Nectum, is now recruiting essentially volunteers to study to sign up for this study. You know, can we create a bank of human brains that have gone through this process where we can show to any independent investigator that these are actually really well-preserved brains? These brains are just as well preserved as if they were alive, if you were to take a biopsy of a living person's brain. And that's where it's at currently. This is not something that is currently available for you to sign up for. But the idea is that in the future, you can, either once you learn that you are moribund, right, that you have a terminal diagnosis, or even well before that, as you're kind of getting ready for your estate planning, that you can, you know, sign up for this service and create what we call like an advanced directive or a living will that specifies that, you know, at the time of your death, there are certain steps that the healthcare team taking care of you should take in order to ensure a successful preservation. And, you know, the this kind of conversation, having this with your doctor, I think is relevant now. You know, It's a time in the world's history where we're seeing a lot of death, unfortunately. And I've had many conversations with my elderly and chronically ill patients about, you know, what should I do if I get this virus? Should I allow the paramedics to put a tube in my throat and sedate me, knowing that there's a really good chance I might never wake up, that I might die alone in the ICU without my family, without being able to say goodbye, with no quality of life in the last few days of my life, just on this very small chance that I might pull through, even though I'm 75 and I have diabetes and I'm pretty sure I wouldn't. You know, so these are really difficult conversations that I'm having right now with a lot of my patients, what we call advanced care planning. And, it's very individual, very gut-wrenching conversation, but important. And I think that this is something that needs to become commonplace, and not just when people are old and sick. You know, I think we need to be having these conversations when we're young and vigorous, about what do we want from healthcare and from our own lives as they come to a close. But we don't like to talk about it. You know, we don't like to even think about the fact that we are mortals and that we will die. When we do think about it, it causes all these negative emotions. Fear and you know, I can't believe that, and you know, disbelief, I guess, and loss and grief. And I think as you look at the responses to those emotions through the ages, you can kind of see patterns of the way that societies and individuals have responded to this problem of death. You know, one of the things that makes us unique as humans is we think, as far as we know, we're the only animals that know that we're going to die. And that knowledge has really shaped what it means to be human. And I think for Mormon transhumanists, and you know, especially, but religious people in general who believe in the resurrection, that unique approach to the problem of death—that death is actually not the monster that gets the final say. It's a temporary, a temporary state that God will fix through grace. But that's one, I think, really beautiful. And in many ways, healthy approach to death. You know, it helps to people not to live in constant existential fear, and to delay gratification in this life because they really believe that, you know, there's a better life ahead, and that if they live a moral life now, that they'll be able to recoup those lost opportunities for pleasure and things like that. And so I personally think believing in an afterlife, even if it may not be, you know, true in a supernatural or magical way, is still a good way to live. But if it isn't true in a physical or materialistic way, if it's possible, to me that's even more powerful. And I think that's a worldview that you can be widely applied beyond the confines of one specific religion.
Yeah. Well, It's interesting too, the picture you're painting here too. I don't think it necessarily has to be, you know, a big, bad, scary thing. And even how I think about funerals in general, I don't think they need to be as big, bad, and scary. Although I will say I probably have blind spots in this because I haven't lost anyone super, super close to me. I've lost a grandparent, but no one super close to me I've lost. But when I think about this idea of like preserving my body, being vitrified, basically kind of being turned to glass, and how you're talking about data preservation and stuff, this could be a really beautiful way to preserve the person you love or the people you care about. It preserves them in some sort of intact state. And I could even see like on our tombstones or gravestones or whatever, having like barcodes and like, you could go to my blog and learn about me or like GoFundMe, make a donation to bring Blair back.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is. And the funeral could be more a celebration of all the things that I did in my life and things like that, followed along with, here's still the information, here's the data. It's, you know, and I think in some ways in Mormonism, we kind of do this, we kind of have this attitude of this is a goodbye, this is a see you later. But I don't know if we take it to the full extent of, oh no, but we're going to be the ones to bring you back. And that's where I want to switch back over to Lincoln, because you have a really good pulse on what like the average Mormon imagination is about resurrection and things like that. How do you think a lot of like traditional believing Mormons would, or Latter-day Saints would take to this idea of having their body vitrified?
I don't think that the idea of having a vitrified body would be particularly troubling to most Mormons. As Jordan pointed out, we're already doing embalming processes on the bodies that, you know, most Mormons are burying these days. My own father was embalmed when he died, and I was involved in the process of dressing his embalmed body with his temple robes before he was buried. My grandfather and I did that. It was a strange experience because his body was so heavy from the embalming fluids that it kind of shocked me at first when I went to move the body. And my grandfather noticed that I was shocked, and he put his hand on my shoulder and told me it was okay. And I said, I'll be okay. And I just pushed harder the next time. But so I don't think that vitrification in itself is really a challenge for most Mormons. Of course, there's always going to be exceptions. What I think is more of the challenge for most Mormons is maybe one of two different things. Number one, the idea that we are supposed to be involved in doing the resurrection at all. I think a lot of Mormons have been taught that Jesus is going to do all of that work. And in fact, from some perspectives, not only is Jesus going to do all that work, Jesus already has done all of the necessary work for the resurrection. And our job is simply to work on being better people. And I totally share with them the sense of importance about working to be better people. In fact, I don't think that human civilization will survive long enough to attain the technologies necessary for technological resurrection unless we become much better people than we are now. The technologies that we already have often put us on the brink of major disaster worldwide. And of course, we're facing major global risks presently. But the technologies to come are going to make the technologies that we already have look small time. And so the learning to live with love and compassion and cooperation and all of the virtues that the gospel of Jesus Christ advocates is of principal importance, more important than being able to resurrect the dead today. But when we live in accordance with those principles, I think we develop a society that can survive the risks inherent in greater power. And as we develop into that sort of society, I trust that God will continue to grace our society with that greater power and then expect us to use it responsibly. So that kind of leads to another thing that I think a lot of mainstream members of the church, mainstream Mormons, Latter-day Saints, may have concerns with. And that is this idea that, okay, well, if I imagine for a second, maybe Jesus does want us to help with the resurrection. Maybe I can go that far and imagine that Jesus wants us to help, like you said, raise the dead. And maybe that does have something to do with more than just, you know, bringing people back to mortality. Maybe there's some work to do. I'll assume it for a second, but there's a bigger problem, they would say. It's not enough to do this cryonics thing, because what about my grandparents who are already dead? Or in my case, my father who's already dead. And he wasn't cryonically preserved. He wasn't vitrified. He's rotting in a hill a few miles from where I live right now. And I'm pretty sure he doesn't look very, very good anymore. And I doubt that the folds in his brain are preserved to any useful level. Well, to any useful level by today's technological standards. And, you know, what about him? What about them? And then take a step further back. What about all of the other humans who have lived for centuries or millennia? If we're really going to go with the beating heart of Christianity, it's about a universal resurrection. That's the prophecy. The prophecy is that we'll all be resurrected. We will all rise. You know, those of us who aren't changed in the twinkling of an eye, as Paul puts it in the New Testament. So how do we do that? And I think a response to that would be, you know, Jordan already hinted at this a little bit. Cryonics and vitrification are kind of one of potentially many approaches to technological resurrection. The nice thing about cryonics and vitrification is that they preserve this very large database that we can use to hopefully work with and create new bodies that match the parameters of the old bodies. We aren't actually going, that's a common misconception. A lot of people think we actually expect to use that dead body and like fix it. It's probably a lot easier to just use the data from that body and create a new body that's more robust, what we might call an immortal body.
The data harvesting procedure would almost certainly destroy the body that's been preserved in most, yeah. I mean, in every theoretical case.
Yeah, so it's a misconception that people think that we're going to actually use the dead body. We'll give people better bodies. That's the idea. But, and so it's a great database for that. But what about in cases when we don't have a database? Well, another approach that Jordan kind of alluded to is something that people call mind files. And that might be the combination of all of your social media and family videos and the documents you've ever written, all your email you've ever written. And combining all of that together, applying advanced artificial intelligence algorithms to it, we might be able to extrapolate much of the same data that we can pull out of a preserved brain and body. Now, that's hypothetical. We don't know that we can do that. But that's a possibility that some people trust in faithfully. And what I mean by that is that they're not just saying, it might be possible. They're saying, it might be possible, and I'm going to work to see if we can do something like that. That's not near at hand, but it's things that people are taking little baby steps toward. Beyond that, there are also even more hypothetical things that might take us a step further towards answering this call to universal resurrection. And a kind of an umbrella term that I give to these more speculative, more far future ideas, I call it quantum archaeology. And the idea is, and Jordan also alluded to this briefly, is that time and space itself might be preserving information in ways that we can access using future technologies in ways that right now we can only barely imagine and throw into science fiction books. There might be ways to scan data from the past, pull that data into the present, and again, reconstruct a sufficient database for producing an adequate body for a person. But maybe that won't really be the person, some people will say, because all we've done is we've copied all this data. Well, the thing is that your body already changes all the time. You actually don't require a perfect copy of anything for it to be psychosocially sufficient. And what I mean by that is that psychologically it's sufficient for you to identify yourself, and it's socially sufficient for all of your family and friends to point at you and say, yep, that's my daughter, my son, my father, my mother. It just has to be psychosocially sufficient because it changes all the time already. So if we can get that amount of data to create a psychosocially sufficient brain and body, and if that brain and body then can function in the same way that a newborn baby's body functions to get its spirit functioning in a way that we all say, yep, that's a person. If that newly created body can do the same thing, and maybe God has to be involved there. Maybe not. Maybe consciousness is pervasive and the brain and body act as a way of kind of impinging on this universal consciousness. I don't know. You can approach this in a lot of different ways. There's not one right way to approach it. But if the brain and body can be reconstructed using any of these technologies, and if it's possible to that brain and body can be reassociated with our experience of a spirit or a mind or a person, then you have ultimately, given, you know, enough time and technological advancement, because we survive long enough our own immoralities towards each other and cooperate well enough over time, we have then a technological resurrection that's approaching the universal.
Well, and yes, to everything you just said. And also, I kind of want to present the question, whoever said we're all going to be resurrected the same way? Like, there isn't more than one way to do this. For example, bringing back someone like my son who was dead for a minute, as opposed to someone whose body is cremated, well, they're not going to be resurrected the same way, obviously. Different material types will obviously require different or more advanced technologies. I also want to, again, also with the average Mormon, I don't know about you guys, but I was brought up with a love of family history and genealogy. That was all part of things. I had family journals. My dad read them to us during FAT. We were told the stories of Amanda Barnes Smith and her faith and the face of the mob and how she healed her son through, you know, prayer and Jesus Christ and some sage leaves out in the back. And I grew up with this idea that, like, our ancestors weren't this thing, you know, that we're just gonna look back fondly on. That there's a reason we're digging up all this information. And I think this is how things like Family Search and
Ancestry.
Thank you, Ancestry.com. That, like, this is already ingrained in the Mormon idea of, like, I just want to present the question: why are we collecting the data? Why are we doing genealogy work? What is the purpose?
We're keying the resurrection database.
Exactly. You're just collecting data at this point. And it's an important job and an important thing to do. And I think it's more than just collection. When you get so much of it, you eventually get to the point where you want to actually do something with it, right? So I also wanted to ask this idea of a universal resurrection, right? Because this is also kind of, it's not just a theological issue. This is also, I think, Lincoln, you touched on it earlier, an idea of, like, an elitist issue, right? Like, who gets to come back from the dead and who doesn't and things like that. Jordan, I would love your take a little bit on mitigating for the risks of people who are like, I don't have a lot of money. How is this going to work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that there's really good scriptural precedent for this. You know, in the scriptures, it talks about a first and a second and third resurrection. There are multiple rounds of resurrection, if you will, and that's based on some sort of objective measurement of merit. And I think that, you know, we can all easily agree that God is, you know, a good judge of character, and that, you know, it makes sense that God should be able to choose which people get resurrected first and to which degrees of glory and things like that. I think it's more problematic when we start taking that upon ourselves and figuring out who in the first place deserves to be preserved in this way using the cutting edge of our science, and who deserves to be brought back, and in what order, and what should those digital afterlives look like, and what purpose would those souls you know, serve? Would they be there just to enjoy their eternal reward or punishment, as it may be, or would they be expected to be contributing members to society, you know, to earn their keep, so to speak? I think these are all really interesting questions, and I think that as a humanist and as a man of faith, I would have an incredibly hard time accepting a world in which only the super rich and the super powerful would have access to these kinds of technology. I would rather see that technology not exist, personally. I think that would be a kind of hell if that were the only kind of humans that we were preserving. I would want no part of that future. But if you're talking about a future where the least of these, where the humble and the meek and, you know, the poor in spirit are also have an equal share of that life, either through massive philanthropy, right, where every person who kind of pays their own way would also pay the way of, you know, dozens or even hundreds of others that were selected based on some sort of merit, or where we made, you know, where it was a taxation thing, where it was a birthright of every citizen, where we all pay taxes, and we all pay taxes because we all feel like we deserve this chance at life beyond death. You know, I would like to see some sort of program like that. And personally, I don't care which one it is. If either way gets there better, then I say we take that way, if it's philanthropy or it's taxes. I just want to make sure that that's the kind of future that we are opening up here. And I do think that there are probably some metrics that we could all decide upon that would help us to favor preservation of one person. You know, if that person has really unique experiences, for example, like the last person who recently died, who fought in World War I, right? That is a unique, you know, no one else in the world can say that they remember what it was like to be rescued on the beach of Dunkirk, right? Or I'm sorry, that's World War II. My apologies. But you get what I'm saying. You know, these really singular experiences, or maybe that person has, you know, a really unique and talent or gift that we think is valuable to the future of our species, and we want to preserve that. And I think also that we should strive for radical inclusiveness and diversity in whatever sample of humanity that gets, you know, stored for this sort of future project. I personally am not a big proponent in, you know, the individual soul. To me personally, it's not that important that I get preserved, that I get a chance at living with my family. I think that's kind of egotistical. What is important to me is that enough of us get preserved as a species that we survive, you know, that because some of my genetics exist in all of my human brothers and sisters. Some of my ideas exist in all, you know, many of my close group. And those are the things that I care about preserving for the future, right? That's the stuff that needs to persist in order for us to escape the existential risks that we face. And so I guess I'm more of a Buddhist in that way. I don't, you know, think about the self as being this all important thing that we have to preserve. I'm more interested in the grand we, making it out of this alive.
So when I get resurrected, I will make sure you're resurrected, kicking and screaming along the way, because you are part of the great we.
So, amen.
You're coming with us, whether you like it or not.
You bet, Jordan.
That's fine.
So you touched on some really interesting points here. And one of the points I wanted to talk about is we've talked a little bit about this idea of elitism and this idea of the super wealthy and things like that. And how my Facebook post came about was people talking about the church's finances, right? The church's finances. And as we all know now, the church has $100 billion, and that's a lot of money. And people are making the waves in the transhumanist corridors and Reddit and things like this. And people are all talking about, yep, we're going to build that resurrection machine. We're going to plug it into the temple and fire her up, you know? And so there's a lot of fun jokes and things like that being had, but my post was one of the big objections, and I love Mormon theology. I love it so much, but we have to also get into the less desirable parts of Mormon theology and folklore and what that includes. And my biggest concern was, okay, let's say the church takes this seriously and starts resurrecting people, you know, or investing heavily into these resurrection technologies or preservation technologies and things like that. Are we going to continue to perpetuate our racist and cis-sexist and heterosexist attitudes that have been perpetuated in the church and in Mormon theology? So, for example, like ideas of like when people of color were becoming more righteous, their skin was turning white. Look over here. Look, their skin is turning white. It's like, whoa, we're going to have to grapple with that. Or more recent theologies popping up within the last couple of decades that when queer people are resurrected, don't worry, you'll be resurrected and you won't be queer anymore. We're gonna fix that for you. My husband Drew, he often jokes with me. He'll just like randomly come up to me and he'll be like, "So Blair, are you excited about the resurrection when you're not queer anymore? Being straight's the best, you know?" And so we do have these like crazy ideas all intertwined in Mormonism with these things. And so it really brings into question, like, who is in charge of bringing back whom? And let's say we get really good with CRISPR and we can start genetically engineering people and changing people. And it's still them, but it's just the straight them and things like that. And so I just want to kind of like say or put at ease for people who do have these concerns that are like, Mormon theology is really cool and I love this idea of eternal families, but they're going to try and make me straight, or, you know, how is that even going to be me anymore? I won't even be me, right? And then they'll say, don't worry, we'll even cut out the desire to be queer, so you won't even want to be queer anymore. And it's like, no. So I feel like that's a place where we as Latter-day Saints and as Mormons need to reevaluate what it means to exactly what you're saying, Jordan, respecting this idea of diversity and inclusion. And that we don't need to chop up people's DNA or their skin tone or anything else to make them worthy of being a resurrected being other than, you know, just being yourself.
Blair, may I comment on that? In the 88th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, it talks about the resurrection. And in that section, it says that people will be resurrected according to their desires. And that, you know, it even goes so far as to say that, speaking in the voice of God, because what good is giving a gift if it's not desired? So point being that resurrection is to be done in accordance with Mormon theology, can't be done according to somebody else's desires for you. That's not Mormon theology. Mormon theology is that the resurrected person should be resurrected according to that person's desires. And I think that there are profound ethical ramifications to that theological position. You know, in the book of Revelation in the New Testament, it talks about the disciples of Christ judging the world during the millennium. And as Jordan pointed out a few minutes ago, we often think that God would be the best judge. Christ would be the best judge. We trust in the grace and the justice and mercy of God, of Christ. And yet the New Testament says that it's going to be our responsibility to join Christ in doing that judging. And in fact, of course, the New Testament teaches clearly over and over again that it's our job to become Christ with Jesus. And a part of that role of being Christ is to judge. But as Joseph Smith modified a translation in the New Testament to be, we should judge righteously. And that means with compassion, with love, and loving others as we love ourselves and loving God above that. And I think that all of that points to ways that we should approach resurrection and thinking about resurrection. There is not one right way to resurrect everybody. Of course not, because everybody is different. And Mormon theology has never supported the idea, despite some Mormons teaching the idea. Our scriptures have never supported the idea of a uniform resurrection. And so I think that that's an aspect of Mormon theology that we should emphasize more, that resurrection should be in accordance with the person's desires. And that seems to me to be something that, if approached ethically, technological resurrection could achieve.
May I jump in there with the comments as well? So, you know, one of the things I love most and that's really stuck with me from my Mormon upbringing is this love of genealogy and family history work. But half of my family is Jewish. And, you know, so the whole impetus to collect that work, to do it in the temple, you know, and for the Jewish people, that's problematic, right? However, nobody disagrees with the fact that the number one resource in the world for doing Jewish or any family history work for that matter is the LDS Church, right? They have compiled more extensive, searchable, user-friendly data on how to, you know, look for your ancestors and learn about them than anyone else in the world for almost every group, including Jews. However, they are respectful of the fact that, you know, people of Jewish inheritance do not want the memory of their ancestors to be dishonored by putting it through unwanted Mormon temple ceremonies. And in large part, the church has respected that. Now, there are individual members who continue to flaunt that request of the Jewish community because either they don't know, or because they, you know, feel in their heart that they, you know, well, they don't really know what they want. They, you know, if they really understood, they would want it, and they'd do it anyway. But I think that that's a really important thing that we're already doing. We're already showing respect to the dead who don't want to be Mormonized, right, in their death. And I think that something similar will need to happen. We'll need to be able to respect people's wishes about staying dead if the future is not something that they feel like they would want to live in, you know. If, you know, God forbid, but if the future is more white and, you know, Western and hetero cis normative than it is, you know, than now, if it's some sort of dystopic future, you know, people who are lesbian, bi, gay, trans, you know, may not want to live in that world. And we should respect their wishes to not bring them into that world. We should allow them to remain dead. And I think that right to determine, have some self-determination about your own afterlife is an important one that needs to be codified in whatever, you know, system eventually, you know, we build.
Well, and I just want to add to just a ray of hope and sunshine in this is that that while LDS theology or folk theology that happens from within, and there are definitely some negative things to consider, like everybody will be white in the celestial kingdom and everybody will be heterosexual, that there is a precedent for change. Because if there's one thing we can count on, is the LDS Church changes frequently. We have continuing revelation. Bam, we don't like something anymore. Continuing revelation, we got that covered. So we kind of have this beautiful way of adapting to the needs of the people. And so when people raise their hand, or as I like to put it, agitate, lo and behold, sometimes continuing revelation shows up in all its glory and sunshine. I think about how things have changed significantly concerning our teachings on Black people, you know, teaching that that Black people were cursed in some pre-mortal existence. We no longer teach that. And we've had many Mormon authorities come out and say, no, that was wrong, shouldn't have done it. No formal apology yet, that would be nice. But there are many who are condemning it, saying, no, that's wrong. Likewise, the church literally used to use technology and pioneer conversion therapy techniques that put electrodes on queer people's genitals and all sorts of things. The church spearheaded these things. The church has now come out and condemned conversion therapy and said, this is not good. We need to stop doing this. So there is room for progress. There is room for change. And sometimes I think that, and I'll lump myself in this category too, sometimes I get really cynical and think things aren't going to change. It will get better, that blah, 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 blah. But it's just not true. It's just not true. Things do change. They change every day. And with that, I'd also say what you're saying, Jordan, that we're now becoming more aware that we're part of a globe that has a lot of different faiths going on. And so if Jewish people are like, hey, could you not do that temple ritual for us? We're like, oh, okay, yeah, we didn't realize that was offensive. We thought we were patronizingly saving your souls. But if you don't want that, you know, there's other ways we could go about doing this right in more respectful ways. So I just wanted to say that there is hope, there is room for change, and even the most cynical of progressives, I like the way Steven Pinker said it. He said it the best. I may say it incorrectly, but he said something along the lines of, it's funny to me how progressives can be so against progress. And it was literally like the best thing ever put, is that sometimes as progressive people, and I would consider almost all transhumanists progressive in some regard, because you're looking for progress, at least in the philosophical sense, is that we need to keep our spirits up and recognize that tomorrow's always going to be different than today. And if we keep doing one thing better than the next day, who knows what the future holds for us and what that's going to be. I certainly don't see a future where it's just wealthy white males in a homogenous society of people. If anything, history has demonstrated the opposite. We have interracial marriages. We have more genders than we've ever had before, and people expressing themselves in ways that are just amplifying diversity. If the rate we're going at right now, the trend that is, that the future, the resurrected celestial kingdom, whatever that looks like, it's going to be hella diverse. It's going to be crazy. And we're still going to have problems, and we're still going to be working through them, but that's what it is. It's all part of the process. Anyway, on that note, I want to thank you both for coming so much and offer you an opportunity if you have any more closing comments or anything to add on your ideas of a technological resurrection.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, I'll close with a thought from a Russian Orthodox priest. His name was Nikolai Fedorov, a Christian. And Nikolai Fedorov, because of his deep familiarity with the Christian tradition and his emotional attachment to that tradition, his inspired attachment to that tradition, combined with his awareness of the science of his day and the technological possibilities of his imagination, he encouraged humanity to embrace a common task of technological resurrection. And he prophesied that if we would do that, we would eventually achieve world peace through this common purpose, this shared purpose. And I think that he was exactly right. I think that the death of the body and the mind, as the Book of Mormon says, are awful monsters. And that if we work together to combat those awful monsters, then we'll stop demonizing each other so much, and we will make a better world to live in. And then we'll want all of us to be resurrected into that. So there's my closing thought.
Thanks.
Well said. And I feel like my personal longings for, you know, helping people to achieve longer, healthier lives through the applied practice of medical science, which is what I've chosen to dedicate my professional career to, that this is a natural extension of that. I believe that I have faith, I guess, in our potential as good people through the ethical use of our technology, that we can create a better world. A world in which death and disease are not a given, that they're seen more like something that we can do something about. And that will create a radical change in what it means to be human. And it will give rise to levels of compassion that have previously only been imagined in fiction and scriptural writings. I believe that that is our destiny, if we'll take it. If we'll apply it, I believe that it's possible. I don't see any hard limit to what we can achieve as long as we don't destroy ourselves in regard to this. And for me, after my belief in a supernatural and sort of magical afterlife evaporated, this was how I became able to face the problem of death for me personally. And later, as I started to see myself as less important than I really thought I was for us as an intelligent species, as a real jewel of consciousness in this vast void of emptiness, which is the universe, as far as we know, we're it. And I would like us to continue. I would like us to persist. And if we can, I think that given enough time, we will become something that if we saw now, we would be unable to distinguish between, you know, that future humanity and what we call God. And it's that that gives me faith in our future and makes me want to work towards doing a little bit to make that happen.
Thank you so much, both of you. Like, that was so beautiful. I almost want to end with a closing hymn in prayer, but I won't. That was so beautiful. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. This has been another episode of the Sunstone Podcast, and we'll catch you next time.